The real, like, defining moment when you become a real prisoner, a long-time prisoner for the others, for the newcomers, is when you reach 1 year, 365 days.
Hello and welcome to Off the Books, where we surf the uncharted waters of accounting, finance, risk, and wherever else the waves take us. This episode is brought to you by Workiva, the platform for assured integrated reporting. So it brings financial reporting, sustainability, audit, and risk teams together for integrated reporting that's just as solid as my grip on this cup of Diet Coke.
Nice.
My name is Steve Soder, accounting enthusiast and Diet Coke aficionado. I'm looking forward to debiting a great conversation, and I'm so happy to have you with us. I'm also, as always, happy to have Catherine Tsai joining us. Catherine, do you want to introduce yourself?
Sure. I'm not an accounting enthusiast or Diet Coke aficionado, but I'm a professional asker of questions. I like to drink venti soy chais, and I'm really happy that we have our producer, Mike, coming on camera.
Hello. Yes. Often here, rarely seen producer Mike Gravano, recovering Cherry Coke addict. And the reason I am here today, we are not doing a movie episode, but Catherine and I went to II International and got to talk to a whole ton of folks in the world of auditing, including the keynote speaker from that conference, Xavier Justo, who was a fascinating individual to talk to. He was tied to the scandal surrounding 1MDB. A handful of years back, which was an investment fund of the Malaysian government. Somehow, hundreds of millions of dollars of the fund ended up in the Malaysian prime minister's bank account.
Ooh.
Yeah, juicy. And Xavier, or Javier, he speaks like four languages, so he says his name in all the languages. But he worked for a Saudi oil exploration company that was convicted, and he was convicted of blackmail in 2015. He was accused of basically asking a reporter for money in exchange for information about his employer's business with 1MDB.
It's an interesting story. And he ended up spending 18 months in jail in Thailand, which sounds harrowing. And he got to tell us about it. So let's hear from Xavier Justo right now.
Thank you so much for being here. Could you introduce yourself to our listeners?
So I'm Xavier André Justo. I'm a Swiss and Spanish citizen. I'm almost 50 years old of age, and I'm considered as the whistleblower on the 1MD Petro-Saudi case.
I want to take our listeners back through your experience. So what was your first inkling that something just wasn't right?
So I spent 1 year in London being the number three of the company Petro-Saudi. I didn't see what we can call a smoking gun. I had some doubts because Patrick Mahoney and Tarek Obaid were spending a lot of money. And when I say a lot of money, it's a lot of money. They both purchased properties in London. Patrick also purchased a nice chalet in the Swiss Alps. Everything was about traveling in private jet. Whatever the dinner was, it was probably $1,000 bill per person. The best wine, the best food, everything was supposed to be the best. But, as I said, I didn't see anything illegal. I had some doubts because there was a lot of money flying around, but nothing that I could consider as a proof of guilt. Mm.
So what was a tipping point for deciding to come forward?
So what happened is that I spent 1 year at Petro-Saudi London, and I left the company after 1 year because I was not satisfied about my personal relationship with Tarek Obaid. The business was great. I mean, I was working in the oil industry. It was a first experience for me. It was fun, but I couldn't stand the behavior of Tarek, principally. So I left. I went back to the Southeast Asia with Laura, my girlfriend, who became my wife. And after a couple of years, I was contacted by a British journalist. It's Claire Castle Brown, and she said during the conversation that she heard my name about the Petro-Saudi 1MDB deal, and that maybe I could help her in her fight against corruption in Malaysia. And I told her, I'm okay to meet and to talk to you if you come to see me in Thailand. And that's what happened after a couple of weeks.
And you spoke with her on the record?
It was quite a long process. So what happened is, so she came to visit me in Bangkok. We met the first time. Contact was very great. She's really a great human being. And I showed her some of the material that I had in my possession. And she was convinced that I could be helpful in exposing the scam. And she asked me, and I will answer, I will tell you that very, very openly and very honestly, because I have nothing to hide. She said, how much I wanted for this information. And I told Claire, it's not about the money. If I want to make money with this data, it's not really complicated. I just need to contact the Jolo entourage or the former Prime Minister of Malaysia entourage. I could probably sell those information for a few tens of millions. So I told her that Petro Saudi, my former company, still owe me a couple of million dollars. And I said, Claire, if you can find a buyer for $2 million, the material is for you, because I wanted that money as a kind of insurance. Sure. I was clear since the beginning. I told her, I think I could be facing some problems if I give you this material. I wasn't expecting the kind of problems that I had later. I was mainly thinking about legal problems,
right,
transmitting information and so on. So probably I will have to defend myself, and you can't fight rich and potent people with small money. I told her, and she was okay with that. So you have to keep, we have to keep in mind that my wife was pregnant at that time. It was my first child, and still my first child. So I had other thoughts. I had other things to do in my life than think about this. So my son was born in October 2014, and she asked me in January, February to go to see her in Singapore with some businessmen that were interested by having the data to people fighting corruption in Malaysia. So to make the story short, I went to Singapore. I think it was the 15th of February. I spent the day with those people, these two guys. They brought also an IT team, because something that people have to realize, that the data that I had, it's a 90 or 91 gigabytes. It contains 220,000 emails.
Wow.
In four different languages with attachment. If we, on average, probably, and it's more than that, but let's say on average, every email, it's a 5-page with the attachment. We're talking about 1 million page. If you translate that in a normal book, those are thousands of books. So you can't go there like randomly and find the material, but with IT guys, they have some tools to check more correctly and more quickly. So I spent the day with them. They explained me the scam, because they knew it was a scam. The only thing they didn't have were the proofs, right, that I had. And I had the proofs, but I didn't know how the scam was built. So with their knowledge and my information, together, we did it. I mean, 1 + 1 = 2.
Yeah.
So that's how we started. And so going back to the money, because I had this question quite often. Initially, I asked for the 2 million, as I told Claire. But when the moment came, and when we spent the days talking about corruption, how this money that was siphoned out of Malaysia was supposed to go for building, as I said, a school, road facilities, medical supplies. I mean, real thing for real people.
Yeah.
So I gave the data for free, because it was the only thing that could be done. Don't sell the data. Give the data. And I will face the problems, and I will solve the problems. But again, I was not expecting the kind of problems that that came.
Because I know you ended up in Thai prison, right? What were the charges? How it feels like such a strange leap.
For people not familiar with Thailand, and I love Thailand. As I said, I was engaged there. I married there. My son was born there. So I really and still have a big love for this country. But at that time, the country was run by a military regime. Mm. So believe me that the book of law is just a kind of concept.
Gotcha.
So if they want to arrest you, the police will come, they will put a kilo of drug in your bag, and that's it. They don't need to check. They don't need... Yeah. So there was a case, and I saw the fact. I think it was a British citizen. He was into a dispute for a business with his Thai business partner. And what happened is, they put some pedophile image in his laptop. And he had this computer analyzed by a specialist. And the funny thing is that the image was entered after his arrest. So he said, okay the case is, I'm going to win right. the case. The prosecutor denied the request to check the details of. So in my case, it was very easy. 2 years prior to my arrest, I met Patrick Mahoney in Bangkok. He came for trying to do some business with the Petroleum of Thailand, PTT. And we met, and I told him, you still owe me some money. And he said, don't worry, we'll pay you one day. You know how Tarek is, blah, 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 blah. You will probably be working for us again, blah, 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 blah. And that's it. So they use this visit that was 2 years prior to my arrest. Patrick gave some notes to the police, you know, that I threatened him. That's it, that I blackmailed. And so it was not true. It was not a friendly conversation because right. it was not my friend. It was a normal conversation. I just said, you owe me money. You have to pay me one day. But for the police, it was okay. I mean, they had millions to pay the police, to pay the judge, to bribe everybody. Gotcha. So the only evidences they had were from Patrick's personal notes saying, I met Xavier at the Bangkok whatever hotel. He said that and he will do that. And that's it. So I was charged with attempted blackmail. Attempted blackmail, by the way, in Thailand it's very difficult to go to prison as a foreigner. You really have to commit serious crime. So my first lawyer, they said, I don't worry. This is nothing. You just go to Bangkok, you sign the bail, and you're home. But everything was manipulated in the beginning.
Yeah.
Well, if you could, take us back to the moment where you were giving this information of wrongdoing for free, and then the moment where you found out you were charged, how does that meet up with your expectations of what you thought would happen when you first gave that information?
So I gave the data. If I remember well, probably I have one or 2 days of... that could be mistaken, but I think it was the 15th of February 2015. Claire Castlebrand published the first articles, I think it was the 28th of February. And it immediately became viral in Malaysia. After a little bit in Thailand, it grew up, it took a couple of weeks to reach the United States. And, well, I was surprised that it was so big, but because for me it was, in a way, it was kind of a Asian thing, not really, but it was a worldwide scam. So that was fantastical. First of March, March passed. Okay, they're still free. April, the scandal was so big, I was sure they were going to be arrested. May, the same. And towards the end of June, my wife and my son were in Switzerland. I was supposed to join them for my holidays in July. And the 20th of June, I was supposed to have the visit of the immigration to renew my work permit because we were building an hotel. And it's still very fresh in my memory. It was like yesterday. So I did some sport in the morning. They were supposed to come at 3 in the afternoon. And at 2:55, the maid said, you have a lot of people waiting for you outside. They're coming to the property. So I checked through the window. I said, wow, like 6, 7 cars, normal cars, civil cars, like, I don't know, 10, 15, 20 people coming towards my property. And that was the moment, a few months after the military regime took over. And my first and initial thought said, okay, they are taking the work permit very seriously now. That was my first thought.
Sure.
And, I opened the door. The guy said, Mr. Justo, how are you? I said, I didn't recognize him. But, maybe I know him. I put my hand like this, hello, how are you? And in a blink of an eye, I was like handcuffed, arrested, thrown into the house, and that's where the difficult moments started.
Sure. The nightmare begins.
Yeah.
I was going to, how long did you end up being in prison?
547 days, wow. A year and a half. And it's like in the movies. I mean, I'm not a criminal. I never went to jail, yeah. And I hope I will never go back to jail. So there is a process in terms of timing. So the first difficult moment, except the few first days when you think you are going to die, and sometimes you wish to die, so it's the first month. I spent 30 days here, 1 month of my life. Second barrier is 100 days.
Yeah.
Yeah. You think, oh, Jesus. It's, as I said, prison facility in Thailand is not the Swiss one or the French one. It's you sleep on the ground. My dog has a mattress. You see what I mean? So after 100 days, you in a way, you are quite broken, but it's only 100 days. You have people there for 7, 10, 12 years. Or, and the real, like, defining moment when you become a real prisoner, a long-time prisoner for the others, for the newcomers, is when you reach 1 year, 365 days. People came, you have new people coming every day, and you have to talk because you have nothing else to do. So you try to spend your time in a way socializing with people. And we say you have been here 1 year, they look at you like, oh, you're like in the movie. That's a long-time prisoner. And after you spend a year, you stop counting. You count because you have to count. And you are just hoping for something because there are rumors in Thailand. One of the good things is that there are rumors of amnesty every other month. They never happen, but people are talking about that. So it gives you hope. They will speak about an amnesty because the most well-known monk died, so they have to cremate him. They will give an amnesty. Because it's for the first time in 100 years, you have three planets aligned. It's a nonsense.
Right.
But you want to believe
just
that.
Just grasping at anything.
You have to believe that. You can't believe that you're going to spend 3 years there. It's you can't.
Yeah.
It's not because I am an ex-Swiss banker. I live a normal, quite luxury life. So you can't imagine spending 3 years sleeping on the ground. I don't want to give too many rude details, but In a 30 square meter cell, they will pile up 40, 50 people. Wow. You have to sleep naked because it's so hot. It's so hot, there is one fan for the cell. You have one hole to do whatever your body needs to do.
Yeah.
One hole with a bucket of water for everybody. It's beyond imagination. For the generation that was born in the 60s or the 70s, or people familiar with movies, there is a movie. It's called it's in the Turkish prison, Midnight Express. Mm-hmm. It's pretty much that. You can't imagine that in the 21st century we still have that.
Yeah,
this was probably in Europe a couple of hundred years ago. There is no legality. The guards do whatever they want. For example, if you can buy cigarettes, but you can't buy a lighter because you could burn the place.
Sure.
Who is selling the lighters? The guards. I couldn't get any mail because I was controlled by potent people, but we found a way at the end through a guard that was accepting bribes. They don't provide you with soap, with toothbrush. Everything has to be purchased.
Yeah.
And sometimes the guards that will stop the sales of the toothpaste just to make the price go higher. It's another world. You can only really comprehend that if you have been through that experience.
Yeah.
Well, you were in the cell. What was happening to the people who actually took the money?
Enjoying life, spending their time in nice yachts. There were some pictures of Tarikov Bey enjoying the south of France. But what happened is that the scam was revealed February, March 2015. They were put under investigation only 2 years later. Don't ask me why. That's the way it works. So they had a couple of years of really enjoying life and probably enjoying having their ex-friend in jail.
Sure.
But once they went under investigation, some money was frozen, some money was seized. I did whatever I could, and I'm still doing whatever I can to brought them to really face justice. So Malaysia issued an arrest, request for an arrest warrant, Interpol, money was frozen. So they didn't, Tarik Obaid, for example, has never left Switzerland since 2017, because it's at the mercy of any kind of arrest, any place in the world. Patrick Mahoney is a Swiss and British citizen, so he has been doing London, Geneva. Officially, they have no money. I went. The trial took place in May this year. I went there. I wanted to see them. Stand in front of the judges. So when the judge asked, how do you make your living? Because we see all the money. So, family and friends helping. The thing that people have to understand that officially they stole 750 million, both of them. So in total for both of them. We can imagine that 250 million were like used to help Malaysian people. So they stole for themselves half a billion. Switzerland recovered between the UK, a little bit in the US, and Switzerland, they recovered 250 million. So there is 250 million missing. We can imagine, because they were heavy spenders for the first years, that they used, let's say, I'm going to be over the top, 150 million.
Yeah.
I would have said 5,200, but let's say there's still 100 million missing. So they have friends and family helping. Okay. We gave them so much time to hide the money that maybe part of this money is under nominees, corporate. I mean, the world hasn't changed. You can go to the Seychelles, open an offshore company to put that under a foundation in Luxembourg. You can give the shares to a trust in Bahamas. I mean, if you have the good lawyers for that, money is untraceable.
So other than being stuck in those countries, they haven't really faced justice in any way.
So no, the trial, as I said, it was took part in, I think it was the month of May this year, for 3 weeks. And the sentencing, the verdict and the sentences will be done at the same time, the 28th of August.
Oh, okay.
And Mr. Low is still...
Mr. Low is, if he's still alive, because nobody has seen him for a few years. He's just communicating through his lawyers. I will not be surprised, and I said that many years ago, he's a liability for China. Mm-hmm. There is no interest for... He's probably hiding in China if he's still alive.
Sure.
But he's a liability for China. He has been doing deals with high-level officials in China. Even he was taken... There is a picture of Jolo, and I don't remember if it was a cousin or the nephew of Xi Jinping. So he knows a lot of things. I don't think that China will appreciate having this guy going, being arrested in the U.S. and having a plea bargain agreement and telling all the things he has been doing with some minister or some high-level official in China. So he's a liability for China. I have nothing against China. And nothing, of course, against Chinese people. But state reason in these countries are really very, very important. So if he's still alive, he's just in China, probably under high-level protection and with a lot of money.
Today's episode is brought to you by Workiva. Like most of us, I like to pretend to eat healthy, or at least not exclusively eat Dino Chicken Nuggies. And that's why I'm a big fan of Salad Kits. Yes, this is an ad for Workiva, but it is also an ad for Salad Kits. No longer will I buy a bunch of kale or arugula and sadly watch it turn to green smelly soup in the bottom drawer of my fridge after making a salad for one. No longer will I have to think of crouton pairings, and no longer will I have 14 half-used bottles of dressing in the fridge, even though I know I only like balsamic vinaigrette. I have found culinary convenience in Salad Kits. With the wonderfully paired dried cranberries, carrot strips, goat cheese, and strawberry vinaigrette, you will find financial reporting, ESG, and audit risk convenience in Workiva. Yes, Workiva. When you've got your SEC reporting, ESG reports, 10K, sustainability reports, SOX compliance, risk assessments, and so much more, dear listener, on the same platform, you've got just the right ingredients right when and where you need them. Toss out that old technology your team never liked to use and try Workiva, tailor-made to your processes without all the extraneous junk that just gums up the works. Plus, it's fat-free and low in sodium.
Well, I apologize I'm jumping around in questions here, but
it's
I think...
It's okay. Don't apologize.
For me, I think one of the things that made my ears perk up is just hearing about how widespread or how far-reaching this fraud reached, and it... including like connections to Leonardo DiCaprio's movie, right?
Yeah, because I mean it's when so 1MDB is the Malaysian Sovereign Wealth Fund. So it was used by Petro Saudi. It was used by Jolo again in Abu Dhabi, in Kuwait, with China. So We speak about billions of stolen money. You have to do something with that. And criminals, they want to enjoy their stolen money. A normal guy will say, probably buy a house somewhere and have a nice life. No, they want to be, they steal money and they want to be at the front of the newspapers. So it started with Jolo. Immediately after the Petro-Saudi deal, he was taken in the south of France with Paris Hilton spreading hundreds of thousands of bottles of champagne. He was the big partier in London and in New York. So he wanted to be friends with Leonardo DiCaprio, with the best DJs, best actors, and so on. He was renting yachts for them, private jet, and so on. So, as I said during the conference this morning, I think in a way there is a kind of mental sickness. Because you steal money and you don't hide. Mm-hmm. I mean, we don't live in the 17th century. Now we can know everything about somebody. You had no money, and now you're spending $1 million a day in the casinos in Vegas. I think they gave, I think it was Britney Spears, for his birthday or a friend's birthday, they gave her $500,000 or $1 million for her to jump out of the cake saying, happy birthday. It's very easy. When you steal, it's stolen money.
Yeah.
There is no sacrifice. There is no work for that money.
So why not just?
Well, just why not? Yeah.
Yeah.
And there are so many examples of that. So.
Well, 547 days.
Yes.
At any point, did you regret coming forward?
I have been thinking about that for so many years. You cannot regret doing something good. And again, I did what I did because I didn't know the outcome. That's the beauty of our life. We make choices without knowing the result. Will you join a company knowing that they will go bankrupt in a couple of years? No. Will you accept a wedding proposal knowing that you will divorce in 5 years? No. We do things because that's what we feel we have to do.
Sure.
I talk about what I did with some friends, ex-colleagues in Geneva. There are bankers, there are oil traders, and a few of them said, I will never touch that. It's okay. You have to do what you are.
Yeah.
It doesn't make you a bad person. Action have reaction, and that's it. Do I regret that? No. I regret, as I said this morning, I regret the suffering of my wife. I regret not having been with my son for 18 months. I regret that my poor 80-year-old mother was scared. Yes, that I regret. But what is done. You can't undo things. And you can't, and you don't have to undo good things.
What kept you going? I mean, it sounds like it's such a hellish condition. You shouldn't be there, so it feels like the rules don't matter anymore. So, like, what gave you hope? And
so there are, as you said, there are no rules in prison. Yes, when you enter the prison, they will give you a small book, like rules and regulations.
Sure.
Yeah, sure. There are rules and regulations. There are prisoners' rules and regulations. So you have to adapt. You don't need to be smart. You just need to avoid problems. If you want to have problems on a daily basis, it's very easy. It's like in the movie. You look one of the boss in a bad way. You don't leave them the enough space. It's like a movie is it's a reflection of the reality.
Sure.
So it was very difficult. Mostly at the very beginning. I mean, the first week, after 1 week, I thought I'm going to die. And I even think that I wish that to happen. You have to sleep on the floor. You can't sleep more than 20 minutes on average. You have to go to the toilets. You have people that did their things all around. It's beyond imagination. I have seen like killers, Colombian killers that were crying every other night,
yeah,
because of the conditions. But it's also an experience when you discover maybe your strength or your weakness. So I think I did quite well, not because I'm a superhero, I'm just a normal human being, but I had a son. He was 8 months old, my only son. So you want to see him, and you can't give up in a prison.
Yeah.
And if you give up in prison, you will finish like a slave. And I had a wife. She was supporting me. At one stage, she had to leave because they threatened to arrest her. So you have to fight for somebody. And when somebody fights for you, you as I said, you can't give up. There were very difficult moments. I mean, I had a control visiting list, so nobody could come to visit me without the approval of the director of the prison. So Thai people, they have their neighbors, family, friends. They had daily visits. On average, I had a visit of 30 minutes every 3 weeks. So the feeling of loneliness, it's probably the worst in all of this is the loneliness. You are alone. Even if you are in the cell, you are sleeping with 50 people around you, you are alone. And as I said during the conference, I was sentenced to 3 years, but my good friend at that time in prison, my Bulgarian friend, was sentenced with 50 years.
Wow.
So when you compare, you say, okay, Xavier, this is going to be tough, but you can make it. There is some light at the end of the tunnel. Your friend is your age. He has been hit with 50 years. He was lucky because he's out of prison. He had a couple of amnesty for good conduct. So, I mean, when I say lucky, he spent 7 years.
Yeah.
But he went out with 57, so there's still a lot of years ahead of him. So when you compare their situation with your situation, it was horrible.
Right.
Really, it's a nightmare. It's beyond a nightmare. But I had, and I have a beautiful wife waiting for me. I had, and I still have a son, and I had friends. And it was 3 years. By chance, I did only 1 year and a half. But it's still something that you can do with the good spirit.
Yeah.
But to have a good spirit, to have a strong mind, you need people around you.
Well, what would you say to a young person who sees some questionable behavior but then is worried about the repercussions of coming forward?
We don't live in a perfect system or in a perfect world. It depends on the company. It depends on the policy of the company. It depends on the boss, if the boss is going to support you or is the boss going against you because this new account or this client is bringing a lot of commissions for the bank or for the financial institution. It's not, the question is easy, but there is no single answer. If your boss is supporting you, is a fraud fighter, he doesn't care about the income of the bank because he wants the reputation of this company first, yes, go ahead. If you think that he's going to fire you or you're going to lose your job, there are other ways. You can contact people under anonymity, some lawyers, some NGOs. But you have to, my example is my example. I'm not telling everybody to do what I did. Mm-hmm. You have to do what you can do. If you are afraid of losing your job and not paying the rent of your house or the medical treatment of your son, you have to take the decision.
Sure.
It's never an easy decision. There are consequences. Life will never be the same. I'm not talking about my case, who is really is extreme. But when you expose wrongdoings inside your company without the approval, or you go against your company, there will be repercussions. You have to know it.
Yeah.
You act or you don't, that's a personal choice.
I think people appreciate that you came forward. And we appreciate your experience, and so hopefully we can learn a lot from it. We do try to end every episode, though, with a fun closing question of the day.
Go ahead.
And I know you've written a book about your experience. What would be your second book?
I mean, to write this book, I wrote this book with my wife. We thought at the beginning that it was going to be an easy thing to do because it's our story. We lived through that. We know everything. Writing a book, it's, at least for me and for my wife, it's an excruciating experience.
Was it difficult?
It's unbelievably difficult. You will probably spend 1 day, you will write five pages saying, I did well. And you will take the night to think about it. And in the morning with your coffee, you will read what you wrote the day before. Say, this is not me. I don't want anybody to read that.
Yeah.
So for the moment, there are no projects of writing a second book. The first book was published a year ago, and I'm still in a recovery mode.
Sure.
But there might be another book one day.
So 547 days. When you got out, what did you do to celebrate? Like, what was that good meal? Did you go somewhere?
So,
what was obviously, seeing your wife and son, I know we're up there.
It has been a long time I was released from prison, but this special moment is like it was yesterday. So they transferred me. I was escorted by the SWAT police until to the airport. And when you enter the airport, even if you are with police, or I was with the ambassador, no more police, just escorted by a guy. And this moment, when you enter the airport, you smell perfume. People are well-dressed. There is not this or disgusting smell that they have been through for 547 days. People are well-dressed. They are smiling. They have nice skin. I was like a kid in a toy shop. I was like, oh, Jesus. It smelled good. In the plane, I'm seated. The travel from Bangkok to Geneva, I think I can repeat every single minute.
Yeah.
The first time I had a glass of wine, it was an extraordinary moment. When we were landing in Geneva, I recognized, it's a short flight, the transit, I recognized all the lakes where I was going to fish with my father. I was crying in the plane.
Yeah.
See, if anybody's looking at me, I think we have a mental guy here. And obviously so the police was waiting for me at the airport and they escorted me through another exit, not to be in front of the, there was some press.
Sure.
And so the police escorted me with a car. They drove me to the special place where my wife was there with my son, and you can imagine.
Oh.
I want to cry again. So, there are special moments that not a lot of people are going to live. And I don't wish anybody to live this kind of experience because they are extreme. But in terms of life moment, I had a life, I hope it will continue, full of excitement.
Yeah.
It's when I met my wife and when I said, you want to come with me, we leave Geneva, we go to Thailand. And I told her, you're not going to live the life of a normal kind of Swiss banker. I was not, and she was not expecting this kind of turbulent life. But it's, again, it is what it is. I don't regret the choices I make because they were the right choices. I do regret the suffering for the others.
Sure. Well, Xavier, thank you so much for
sharing
your story and some of your afternoon with us and for speaking up back then.
Thank you. Thank you for having me with you.
Thanks to Xavier Giusto. And thank you, dear listener, for surfing along with us. I'm Mike Gravano, and you just heard from Steve Soder and Catherine Tsai, and this has been Off the Books, presented by Workiva.
Please subscribe and follow us so you can catch all of our upcoming episodes.
And if you like Off the Books, please leave us a review, and by golly, tell your buddies if you like the show. Now, if you're watching this on YouTube, we'd love for you to drop us a note in the comments, or feel free to send us a line at offthebooks@workiva.com. Surf's up, and we'll see you on the next wave.